Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is studio bass player Paul Ill. But first, let's talk about some news from last week, and that's UMG, Universal Music Group, made a big commitment to virtual reality by signing a deal with iHeartMedia, and that's the radio conglomerate, used to be Clear Channel, that now owns, I don't know how many radio stations, a lot all over the country, as well as the iHeartRadio app that a lot of people listen to. So this is a big deal when it comes to virtual reality. And again, I've been predicting the virtual reality is going to be the next big thing, and it looks like it will be. We've been talking about virtual reality in terms of games and in terms of movies. One of the things we haven't connected virtual reality with is music. And really, it's perfect for music, especially concerts. So Universal Music Group kind of got the feel for this, and they signed this deal with iHeartMedia to record 4 events next year, music events. Now, they didn't announce exactly what these are going to be. They could be concerts, or they could be some of the festivals that iHeartMedia puts on, and they put on 5 or 6 festivals in different genres all over the country. So it may be some of those, but nonetheless, they're going to do at least 4, and also they committed to a number of smaller projects, which we presume are going to be virtual reality music videos. Now, one of the cool things about virtual reality is, since it's an immersive technology for picture, it could also be an immersive technology for audio as well. So binaural recording and surround sound are going to be all incorporated into this, and you'll find it'll be one of the bigger things that's happening in 2016. But just the fact that Universal, the largest record label on the planet, has committed to this and are kind of ahead of the game, I think tells you something. So look out for more of this in the future. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is the fact that we already have a number of year-end figures in. Usually this takes until about February or March until we see this, but we're seeing it early this year, and this is coming from Nielsen, and a couple of things really stand out. The first thing is physical album sales actually increased last year by a small amount, 1.1%, but they did increase. Now, they've been falling like crazy at about 10% over the last 4 or 5 years, and just the fact that there's a turnaround here is kind of interesting. Album downloads, however, have decreased by about the same amount, 1.1%. A lot of people think the increase has to do with the Adele effect. She's already sold more than 7 million records in the United States, and it's probably more now. I haven't seen the latest figures. But she's accounted for about 3.9% of all of the physical sales just by herself. 25 was the biggest record of last year by a large amount. And the feeling is that any kind of increases that we see are kind of like one time only because of Adele. That being said, there's some other significant numbers here. One is the fact that streams from Spotify and Slacker and iTunes Music, they went up by about 99% last year to 137.5 billion streams. This doesn't include YouTube and Vivo, and those streams went up 98% last year to 168.6 billion. So between the two types of streams, the video streams and the audio only streams, that's almost 300 billion music streams in the last year. That's an enormous amount. Pretty soon we'll be seeing a trillion. Will it be next year? Probably not, but within a couple of years, I bet we'll see that. One final note, vinyl has gone up another 56% last year, so it's still increasing. I predicted that this will be the last year of big increases for vinyl, but we'll see, because all of a sudden there's turntables everywhere and there's brand new turntables coming out. So in fact, this may be a phenomenon that has some legs, so we'll see. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks with a Small Studio. It's now available by the module. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is the fact that the vacuum tube is going to be making a comeback. Yes, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and that's the agency that is responsible for the internet. Yes, They're the people that actually got that going at first. DARPA is bringing back the vacuum tube. And there's a couple of really good reasons for it. The first is that the vacuum tube can actually do things that solid-state electronics cannot, especially when it comes to high-frequency, high-powered electronics. And this is mostly the realm that we're talking about, the 75 gigahertz range, way, 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 way above hearing. But anytime you need high power at that particular frequency or frequency range, what ends up happening is any kind of solid-state electronics just fries. So the best thing is to bring the vacuum tube out of semi-retirement. The vacuum tube has actually been around, and if you own a microwave, there's a vacuum tube in it. And also, if you fly in a plane, most of the aviation radar still uses vacuum tubes, and we still see it in some radio transmitters as well. So the vacuum tube isn't gone completely. There's another interesting side effect from using vacuum tubes, and that's the fact that they're not affected by EMP. EMP is electromagnetic pulse. And EMP is this pulse that's generated when a nuclear device is set off. And what it does is it fries solid-state electronics. Guess what? Vacuum tubes are immune to that. So as far as the Defense Agency is concerned, there's a good reason to bring back vacuum tubes. How is this going to affect us in the music business? Well, of course, we still like vacuum tubes. You like the sound of them. We have lots of amplifiers and preamplifiers and tube microphones that still use vacuum tubes. I think all of them are manufactured outside the United States, mostly because even though the United States used to manufacture most of them, the OSHA requirements are very, very stringent, and it just makes more sense for a manufacturer to move that offshore. So now we find that most vacuum tubes are coming from Russia or Yugoslavia or China. Well, that may change because when you're doing something for national defense, it has to be American-based. So in fact, we may see some brand new technology coming from this, which would be very cool if we saw some brand new tubes come out of this that maybe sound better and maybe work better and have more advantages, maybe aren't as fragile. And also, it would be very, very cool if they're made in the United States as well. So look for that. Maybe not this year, but pretty soon, I think we're going to see some spin-offs for the audio industry in the vacuum tube realm. My guest today is bass player Paul Ill, who I'd like to welcome back. He was on podcast episode number 3, way, way back when we first started this. Paul has recorded with all sorts of music luminaries, from Pink to Gwen Stefani, Tina Turner, Courtney Love, and a host of others. And I thought he'd be the perfect guy to come in and give us some perspective into what it's like to be a session musician in today's economy. I spoke with my good buddy Paul via phone from his home in Los Angeles. What's the state of the state for current studio musicians? Because things have changed a lot just in the last few years, right?
Yes, that's correct. My feeling is that there is I would venture to say, I'm going to call it a 5-tier system. At the top tier, there's that group of studio musicians, men and women, in all the major capitals for music. I'm talking LA, New York, Nashville, London, big, big cities, right? Mm-hmm. Where there is a variety of multimedia production. There's a top tier of people that seem to be very resilient. My friends that are string players, like orchestral instruments, like anything you would see in a string quartet, upright bass, there's a small group of them, it seems, in every city that seem to maintain a fairly reasonable standard of living since 2008. Then the next tier down are those studio musicians that were primarily studio musicians but had slightly diversified. Meaning that they were not only doing the union record dates and all the independent production stuff, but they had other irons in the fire, like they may have had a few touring things, right?
Mm-hmm.
That group of studio musicians seemed to be able to really stay in the game, but may have taken like a very you know, sobering and objective hit in terms of the revenue stream. Mm-hmm. How deep the revenue stream was. Then there's the third tier of studio musicians, which, dare I say, I'm I'm in the third tier, kind of leaning into the second tier. I am not first tier, right? My work changed radically. The third tier is the vast majority of us. And what I'm talking about are the folks all across the board geographically that were capable of generating revenue, playing their musical instrument into a recorded media for a variety of purposes, whether it was sessions for singer-songwriters or bands or industrial music. And by industrial, I don't mean the genre. I mean like stuff like working on local commercials if you were in a small town, or working on television scores and stuff. And that tier, the third tier, I'll call what used to be the middle class of the studio musician. Primarily that tier took the biggest hit. And what I saw happen was this 90% of my work go away. And I'm not kidding. 90%. And it was nearly perfectly symmetrically proportional to the drop in studios. As I understand it, before 2008, there might have been 600 legitimate commercial audio recording studios in the greater Los Angeles area. And then in a matter of 18 to 24 months, it was down to 30, right? So it would be like to the oil industry if 95% of the gas stations went away.
Yeah.
You know? And then the fourth tier were those individuals that dabbled occasionally, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fourth tier, and I'm not talking about a linear tier vertically, like superior or inferior, like a food chain. I'm talking horizontally more,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Systemically. The fourth tier were the folks that occasionally did a session, right? Who may have done other things, like they may have been making a ton of money touring, say, or they may have a studio or whatever, where they had a clientele that was feeding them or you know, keeping everything going, or they had ancillary businesses that were not related to recording music, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. They may have been a medical doctor, a school teacher, or whatever, you know, a day gig, and occasionally they recorded. Quite a few of those people, it didn't change, right? They didn't, that things stayed the same for them, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Then the fifth tier, which is the one that I have the most emotional feelings about when I assess things and look at it, is the guys and gals that were young, that were in their teens and in their early 20s, or mid to late 20s, that had come to a capital or were trying to set up a thing to where they were the local person in town, the go-to person in town in a smaller town or whatever, or trying to set up an internet recording thing internationally, right? Who hadn't branded themselves, right? Those people took as huge a hit as the people at the top of the food chain. See, what's interesting, without naming any names, I know some people at the top of the food chain that were six-figure, primarily studio musicians, who after the 2008 stock market crash and the onset of what is frankly, very frankly, is a depression. It's not a recession. It was a depression what we experienced in 2008. Those people, I know some people that their fall from grace was so profound that their families couldn't survive it. You know, I had friends who went from having like two Range Rovers, a house in town, you know, vacations, their kids in both private schools, to being unable to make a mortgage payment within a 6 month to 12 month period.
Yeah, wow.
In the downturn, you know, and I mean a radical fall, like extreme. And then I had other friends who were young, just right out of MIT or something, right out of Berkeley, who really, really just didn't have any blue sky potential at all. There was nothing. They were like, whoa, what happened? You know? So the two extremes, then the three in the middle, right? Tiers four, three, and two, seem to be kind of resilient. And I'll tell you, another thing is that I've noticed a recent upsurge in the past 6 months. I have started working again consistently with a handful of producers that are brilliant, that have been around forever, that never quit. One is Michael Lloyd. He started calling me for record dates thanks to a dear friend of mine, Matt Sorm, referred me to Michael on a session. And I've been working with Michael frequently since then. And that really humbles me because Michael has, in his career since the 60s, has used Carole Kaye, Leland Sklar, Joe Osborne, Bob Glaub, you know, people that I really admire and that I aspire to still at my age, I aspire to be like these people, right? So it's really cool. When I go over to Michael Lloyd's, I get to use a Hidley direct box that was built for him for Carole K. Carole K told him to build it together.
Wow.
Back in the day. And I used the box she used. So that was really nifty to do that. I put that picture up on my Facebook and stuff. And so Michael Lloyd, I've started working for Linda Perry again. She's back to making like indie record kind of stuff.
Why is that?
Jack Douglas too.
Yeah. Is that because of budgets? Because I've been talking to a lot of producers and everybody says the budgets are coming back a little, not, you know, certainly not to the level that they were, but the budgets are coming back a little. So
the budgets are coming back. But here, let me explain.
Yeah. Okay.
From a studio musician's point of view, not a producer's point of view or an artist's point of view. This is the difference. The budget used to be for the album model, 8 to 12 songs, maybe 20 songs, right?
Yeah.
Hey, we're going to do 10 songs this week, 10 songs next week. I'm going to send you the music. You're going to chart it out. I want you to come in prepared. Now it's one song. If it's three songs, I'm shocked. That's the difference.
Mm.
And instead of it being a full scale or triple scale, whether it was through the union or indie, now it's, well, we only have... and we got this money from our uncle, you know.
Yeah.
And if you watch any of the crowdfunding sites, you see artists of very, very high esteem who have to use crowdfunding to pay for their recordings if they want to make a traditional album style recording.
When that happens, are you working in a commercial studio, or do you find yourself working mostly in private home studios?
Three things. I'm either working in a commercial studio, very rarely. Like occasionally I still get called to go to like United or something like that, but that's rare, very rare. Most frequently it's a home studio environment where either the artist, the band, or the producer has held onto their gear and moved it into an environment that they can afford, right?
Yeah.
Or it's my studio, Loki Sonic, that I'm partners in. Right.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, can we use your studio, which is a real plus. And that's something I want to share with everybody. If you can create a cool environment where people can come to you to not only record you, but to do other things, to rehearse, track drums. Drums is especially important. If you can create an environment where people can get a good drum sound, where you've got a couple of choices, like a variety of drums and some baffles and some groovy mics, people might come to you and say, oh, let's use that him to, or her. Because we can use our studio. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
You know, when they're choosing, they go, well, we could use bass player A or bass player B, but bass player B's got this really cool room too.
There's a budgetary element in that as well, where I'm sure that there's somewhat of a package deal, right? Use me and use my room.
Well,
it's easier for me. So you get a break on the price.
That's right. They get a break on the rate and or even under some circumstances, because I'm one of the financial partners in the studio. I can go to my partners and say, hey, I want to do the session with these guys. Can we give them the studio for free? Right.
Yeah.
Where it's just value added. They can't say no, right? If they're determining between me and another person. But then the other tier is I do internet sessions on occasion. Our studio is set up to where I can do, somebody will send me, WAV files, tracks. The king of that in my world is Tim Pierce.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And there's a buddy of mine in Cocoa Beach, Florida, whose name I'm going to have to get for you. He's the drummer in Three Dog Night. And I always forget it. Pat Bautz. P-A-T-B-A-U-T-Z.
Yeah,
He's the drummer in Three Dog Night. Drumtracks.com. He was one of the first guys. He was a visionary. He got in. He bought some URLs. And he has a regular clip. Sometimes he sends me stuff to play on for him. The other tier is we have the commercial studio, the home studio, my studio, the internet studio, and then that's it. Those four tiers for where I would record. Then occasionally people, not that often, will say, we're going to do a gig, right? We're going to hire this band. And you guys were playing in a venue where I just did this Tuesday night with Linda Perry, where everything was recorded to multitrack. Right.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty big deal. There were a lot of cool people involved because it was a pre-Oscar party. You know, Christine Aguilera, Ian Asbury, all these Courtney Love, Juliette Lewis, and Linda sang. And that was like it was a given that the money that we accepted to do that rehearsal and that gig, however Linda wants to exploit that media, right, in social media or whatever, is pretty much a buyout these days too, which is very interesting from a financial point of view, because she is impeccable financially. She's very generous, very fair. You always get paid exactly what you were agreed to, you know, and it always, and she bonuses people. She's a wonderful person. And across the board with everyone, quite often now they'll roll multiple things into one recording session. Whereas back in the day, you used to be able to come to people and say, hey, you know that gig you just released, that live album? Well, I was in your band, right?
Yeah.
And you paid me that week to be in your band, but can we work something out for that recording? And they'd be like, yeah, oh yeah, that's right. Let's put that through the union. Or, oh, of course, you're right. Here's a check for it. Right. Everybody from David Bowie down to indie bands used to do that with their sidemen or the people in their bands. Nowadays, it's more like, hey, you're in the band. It's your brand. You've been absorbed into our brand. And whatever we create, if we put out a live record, you already got paid for it.
Yeah.
That's another big change in the recording, like people using a live thing. Like I've seen people, young, especially the really savvy, like millennials and stuff, I've seen them make an entire release, a YouTube video, what they consider the master recording for it, right?
Yeah.
Everything on their iPhone, and pay the band, each person in the band to do the gig, pay them to rehearse and do the gig. And they'll use two or three iPhones and figure it out. And that's their release.
Well, you know, again, you're talking about a different standard of what's acceptable and what isn't. And
that's right.
Those of us who grew up in the old fashioned studio system where, you know, there was a certain level of quality that you had to have, or you didn't have a quote unquote master. It's hard to break away from that. And I'm certainly responsible for this as well, or, you know, part of it. It's hard to break away from that mindset. That you have to have a certain level of quality.
For the studio musicians, the big paradigm shift for that was Beck Odelay. That was the record where people, I have very many close friends in our demographic that were like, wait a minute, what is this? This sounds like demos and it's blowing up. Remember?
Yeah.
Beck Odelay was a game changer for a lot of people. And in terms of, for me as a recording artist, remember, I'm not only a studio musician, but I also write songs sometimes with the people that I work with, because the best work I do is within collaboration. That's why I have a band, my band, Reputable Few. What I do with those guys is much better than the work that I do on my own. And that is, I'm not being falsely modest or trying to promote my band or promote those guys or project some sort of utopian, altruistic creative thing. It's a fact. When you look at my track record and my active copyrights, I have 60 active copyrights out in the world right now on Wixen Music Publishing. If you look at my statement, right? Mm-hmm. And they range most of those copyrights, I was hired first as a session musician with those people, right? Now, ironically, three of those people were on the gig with me that I did Tuesday: Courtney Love, Juliette Lewis, and Linda Perry, right? So the big secret is maintain positive, honest, open relationships with everyone, right? And if you can increase your value to those people without becoming a burden or without becoming inflictive, it's a really tricky balance, right? How do you say, hey, I can do more than play guitar or bass or drums or keyboards or whatever? I can blah, blah, blah for you or with you, right?
Yeah,
how do you do that? How do you get invited to that party? Because I got to tell you, that's another line between the studio musicians that have songwriting credits or are savvy producers as well, are a whole different ball game than the folks that aren't. And one of my best examples is Joe Osborne. Here he is down in Torrance, California with a 8-track 1-inch in his garage. First call guy in the outside the wrecking crew in LA. He was never a wrecking crew guy, but he was working just as much as them. And he hears this band down the street or whatever, heard him, this duo playing in a bar or something, or a Holiday Inn, or somebody told him one of his neighbors has got a real good voice, and he birthed the Carpenters. Joe Osborne's fortunes as a studio musician were radically different.
Yeah.
But he continued to do sessions, right?
But
that's what I mean too.
But the thing about it is, with you, I think that's one of the reasons why people hire you. Besides, you certainly have formidable chops and technique, but it's the fact that you come in with a plethora of ideas. There's always, every time I've worked with you, it's almost like you have so many ideas that you go, well, which one can I choose from? Because they're all really good. So that's unique.
I appreciate that.
I mean, that's unique because most of the time you bring somebody in and they play what's either written for them or they don't contribute all that much, even though they're doing the job. And maybe that's what you want. But most of the time, if there's a great idea, that, you know, certainly that's where you'd rather go. So I can see why you got those. Well, okay, here's a question. Is it more difficult today to get those co-writes?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll tell you why, because those individuals, I don't mean the individuals I was just talking about, but the people that are creating copyrights, right? Like the singer-songwriters, okay?
Yeah.
It's not that they're less likely to collaborate, or it's not like that they've become greedy or selfish with sharing the ownership of a copyright or a master or anything. It's that the systems around them, the managers, the lawyers, their collaborators, whoever is part of the fiscal decision making process, right?
Yeah.
Are less likely to be as reasonable as they were, right?
It's the business infrastructure around them.
I have to be very clear with this. Linda Perry, Courtney Love, and Juliet Lewis are exceptions to that rule. They're very collaborative and they behave the same way they did before the downturn. See, what happened was with the emergence of social media, the digitization of music, and the last two generations of microprocessor speeds, right? Mm-hmm. It became so easy for people to traffic in music for free, right? That if you were branded before 2008, okay, most particularly before 2003, if you were a band like Radiohead, you could navigate a post-digital, the transition to, what are you calling it, music 4.0 now or 5.0?
That's
in your next book.
Is it 4.1?
4.1. You could navigate the tradition through the transition from 3.0 to 4.1 with more resilience than someone who's trying to establish themselves now, right? You follow me?
Yeah.
When it comes to studio musicians as songwriters, it's like this. Either you're Joe South and you're in Nashville in the 60s and you can crank out a tune like Hush, right?
Yeah.
Or, what's that other one? Games People Play, right?
Yeah.
But you're also playing on Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde, right?
Yeah.
And you can sing and you can do a lot of things. He's a force to be reckoned with, a guy like Joe South, right? Or Charlie Daniel. Okay. I don't ascribe to Mr. Daniel's politics, but I certainly respect him as a musician. In the contemporary era, in right here, right now, as studio musicians, as songwriters, and as contributors to copyrights, two forces are at work. There's the hip hop model, to where if you create a beat, or if you create any content to something, you own part of that mass. That's why if you look at some of the really big names in hip hop or R&B, there might be 13 songwriter credits on some of the records, right? I've counted 13. Think about it. David Bowie, Lust for Life, blows up as a Cadillac commercial, right?
Mm-hmm.
What part of Lust for Life did they use? Hunt Sales. Boom, ba, boom, da, boom, ba, da, boom.
Yeah, the intro, right? Yeah.
Does Hunt see a penny of that? No.
Was that Bowie? I thought that was
Bowie. Bowie produced it. Iggy's song.
Yeah. Okay.
I meant Iggy. I'm sorry. I misspoke.
Yeah.
The point is Hunt doesn't see a penny for that. But what are they using?
Yeah. Hunt Sales, the drummer you're talking about. Yeah.
And also from a classical point of view, what are they using? They are using, if an orchestra played that, they are playing notes that can be transcribed, written down, right?
Yeah.
written down, and it's a long enough of a phrase to justify ownership. Right? It's distinct, and it's certainly why, as studio musicians, if you walk into a session, the general rule is if somebody's paying you, it's a buyout. Any yeah. idea that you present is a they're giving you that check to have you in the room to go, hey, I got an idea, like, let's go boo doo boo doo boo boo, and the guitar player goes boom dim boom dim boom dim.
Okay, well, that's one of the things that the Wrecking Crew always talked about, that they came up with all these ideas that actually made the song, and some of them were felt like they're ripped off because they weren't given songwriter credits, and others of them felt, well, like Tommy Tedesco, his famous quote was, they paid him the same amount for the songs that didn't make it as the songs that
didn't make
it, that were hits. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, that's why the visionary producers like Linda Perry and people like her will say, if they'll acknowledge that and go, it's actually better to reward these guys or come to these guys, right?
Yeah.
As occasional contributors to the copyright, but she always clarifies it with her artists first, right?
Yeah.
And she's not the only producer like that. When I work with people, right, in my studio, and other individuals at Linda Perry's tier of talent and accomplishment, I'm way beneath her as a producer. But my point is there comes a point where you have a conscience and you have to say, wait a minute, this is forever changing this. Now, interestingly enough, I had a chat with Warren Haynes about this. He's got a co-write on Three of a Kind, working on a Full House with Garth Brooks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what he said to me was, in Nashville, right, the general rule is, if it's played on guitar and sung or piano and sung, and you change that delivery, right, then you warrant a claim to owning the copyright, which means if we're all at a recording session, a bunch of studio musicians, you're the record producer, or let's say you're the artist, right,
mm-hmm.
and we're sitting around and it's piano, guitar, bass, and drums, and the drummer says, wait a minute, guys, you're all playing, I'm playing the beat here, I'm sitting back listening, I think the bridge should go up a couple of keys. The song needs to lift somehow. Now you've entered into this bizarre gray area. Is he arranging or is he composing?
Yeah.
Is he creating something that for time immemorial will forever change the way people perform the song? The answer to me is yes. He's suggesting a modulation. So because I come from an academic background as well as the street, I think, well, wait a minute, if it changes how this would be transcribed on the written score, doesn't that mean composing? And isn't composing an entirely different skill than arranging? Yes, it is, in my opinion, right? And if you think about it, like a band like Black Sabbath, right? Four-way split for 8 records. Look what they did. They conquered the world because they didn't sweat the small stuff. As soon as those guys started sweating the small stuff, what happened? Acrimony.
Yeah.
U2, 4-way split, no solo albums. Metallica, 4-way split, no solo albums.
The Doors.
They built empires.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Tom Petty, right? Where you've got a force of nature here. You got a guy that can sit there and not really change his musical language all that much. A couple of subtle shifts with Dave Stewart and Jeff Lynne. But really, Tom Petty is one of the great voices of the end of the 20th century and a post-millennial voice for American popular music, right?
Yeah.
Without diversifying his musical language that much. But he comes in, he sits down, he goes, this is what I got. And you don't really need to change anything. You just got to play the right stuff for it.
Yeah, so
he surrounds himself with people like Steve Ferrone or Ben Mott or whoever, you know. That's why Mike Campbell's been there for, 40 years, 45 years, because these guys are... their musical languages are resonant with the artist, right?
Yeah.
They get compensated. But my feeling is for somebody who wants to create recorded music and make a living at it right now as a studio musician, I tell them, get your personal skills together so that you are a self-contained, you're capable of creating your tracks for that person, right? if you're a guitarist, a drummer, a keyboard player, a bass player is your principal instrument, make sure that you can do that for someone with as little help by other people as possible, much like Tim Pierce and Pat Bouts. Have a home studio where somebody can just Dropbox you the files, or they can give, you know, they're going to come over to your house if they want, or your studio, and create with you with as minimal other people around. One engineer is always reasonable, right?
Yeah.
My skill set is such that I like to have a second person in the room with me, even more. Yeah, right. I just like to do that. I prefer to do that. I have friends that are the complete opposite. They want to do it all themselves. They don't care. They can handle the technical challenges that may present. Their rigs are set up for that. And Pat Bouts can give you an amazing drum track, right? Tim Pierce can give you amazing guitar tracks all on his own, all by himself.
I would say
lean that way, because that model seems to be the most efficacious for financially. It's the most, I forget what the word is in financial terms, but where it's got not only the longest legs probably, but it has the least amount of expense, financial, whatever that is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It optimizes profit, basically.
Two things, and I'll let you go here because I know you're busy. One is Steve Ferrone. You just told me that you've played on a couple albums with him. I'm just curious what it's like. Is there a difference playing with someone of that level with him? I know what the answer is already. I just kind of want to hear it from you. What that difference is as compared to some other drummers who are very, very good. But, you know, of course, he's on another level completely. What's that like?
Here's the thing about a guy like Steve, right? What Steve Ferrone is I've used this phrase once already to describe, I think, Linda or somebody, or maybe Julia. But in his own way, Steve is a force of nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to consider that Steve Ferrone has a very impeccable pocket. His natural ability to play a drum set and make people feel good physically, whether you're playing with him or on the dance floor or listening to the music on the radio or on, excuse me, what is a radio?
Yeah,
forgot what that is.
Yeah,
I mean, right. That if you're listening to music on something, on some device, you're going to tap your foot, all right? The other thing about Steve Ferrone is if you remember one of the Tom Petty interviews, like it might have been in the Sound City movie or in one of the Heartbreakers history DVDs, when there's just a certain strength of conviction that Steve, it's musicality and strength of conviction. It's also, he's very spiritually principled, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not kidding. I'm talking about body, mind, and spirit. Steve's embracement of the room, the feeling in the room with him is there's no bloodletting, there's no attrition, there's no velvet rope. He's not better than anybody, but it's in your best interest for you. It has nothing to do with him. For you to sit back and go, Brian Auger, average white band, Clapton, Madonna.
Yeah, right.
Right. And that's before Tom Petty. And then everything else he's capable of doing. The other thing about the great drummers that I've been honored to play with, and the list is ridiculous. Like, if you think about it, as a studio musician, I'm not talking about as a touring sideman, but I've had the honor of recording with Keltner, Ferrone, McLeod, Brian McLeod, right? Ronnie Ciago, an unsung hero, right?
Yeah.
But the real big people that people know, their trademarks are really big, is what I mean, that we just know who they are. One of the things they all have in common, and this is an eye roller for some people, but it's the truth, and it's why one of the reasons why I think I'm empathetic with these people and sympathetic to them, right, is one of the things that they did early on in their musical development was embrace gospel and jazz. Sorry, guys, but I got to tell you the truth. You can draw a line in the sand for me, the kind of music I play, right? And the kind of music I record, whether the result is a Courtney Love record or a Juliette Lewis record or a Gwen Stefani, the most recent Gwen Stefani thing I played on, which is a track called Medicine Man. It might be a single. And it's like this very stark reggae song. The reason I feel that people who have played gospel music and jazz or R&B, old soul music, early in their careers, do something that that Keith Richards says about music. He says, a lot of people can rock, most people don't roll. Right? And, yeah. You know, and it's true. When he's asked about great big rock bands, like, oh, you just played Germany, you played two festivals with, and I'm not going to say who it is.
Yeah.
He goes, how was that? He goes, well, their audience loves them. A lot of people can rock, but very few roll. And he's right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The people that swing, right? Charlie Drayton, another example. Now, Charlie's a really good friend of mine. He is consultant on recordings that I've done for my own personal music, but I've never tracked a song with Charlie. But he's a huge influence on me in the way of approach to music. Matt Apps from Government Mule.
Yeah.
These are some of the great drummers of my time period, right?
Yeah.
Whether they're known or not. What they haven't, Dan Petrucci, the drummer in my band, is Jack Douglas's first call in LA,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Nobody knows who he is. Why is he getting first call? Well, because he can swing.
Yeah.
It's that simple. It's just that simple. And that's one of the thing about Ferrone is the life experience of this guy, right? Not only as a musician, but as a person out in the world, what he's done raising his family and stuff and everything, and all the life experience he's accumulated. His conviction, his strength of conviction. One of the last records we did, you were very helpful with me understanding the technical thing we were coming up against, was this guy from Nashville named Bure, who's like the part of the new Southern rock country music thing that Sturgill Simpson is at the forefront of. The producer was Noah Shane. Steve Ferrone was on drums. I was on guitar, and Bure and his guitar player from Nashville, this brilliant young English guy who I'm embarrassed. I've forgotten his name. I'll find out for you if you need it. But anyway, or maybe you could edit this in a way where it doesn't sound so loquacious and rambling. But we were recording on an old 3M 16 track 2-inch that Nashville Skyline was made on. Right.
Yeah.
And this machine you can't punch on because it's a video. It was a converted. Jack Douglas explained this to me. And you helped me too.
It's because where the heads are located on the head right. stack, there's a long punch in time. Yeah.
Right. So Steve said to me, look, I don't have all day. And he said, I know these songs. You know these songs. Let's just go in there and don't be a bass player. And I go, what do you mean don't be a bass player? He looks at me in his English accent. He goes, every bass player makes a mistake and needs to fix it. Right.
Yeah.
He goes, I don't care if it's Nathan. Even Nathan will say, I need to do that again. He said, we're not going to do it again, all right? Because of this machine, because of Noah's machine. Like, come on, let's go. So we went in, and there's 11 tracks on that record, the Blu-ray record that he and I played on. And 8 of them, I believe, last time I checked with Noah, had no edit to the 2-inch or the Pro Tools transfers.
That's pretty amazing in this day and age. That's
which
great,
is like
though.
The old days.
Yeah, that's great.
Which is like the old days. Eight of them were one of the first 3 takes, and they were, you know, no edits.
Yeah.
So there you have it.
Last question. So what's the best piece of business advice that either you've learned along the way or someone imparted to you?
There's 3. The best piece of business advice is maintain ethical, I call it spiritual principles, but it's really basically simple. Treat others as you would want yourself or your children or your immediate family to be treated, no matter what goes down, right?
Yeah, that's a good.
Treat people as you would want your loved ones to be treated, right? If something happens, think about, wait a minute, now how would, and that means sometimes we have to be really compassionate and forgiving with certain people or whatever. That's the first one. The second one is, multiple income streams.
Yeah.
You know, diversify. I've got 5 income streams to squeak by, right?
Yeah.
You know, 5. Okay. And one of them's non-musical. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
I tell people, don't worry about it. If you got to get what I call the B job, it's God's way of, or the universe's way of, you know, giving your life meaning. Don't worry about it. Ian Anderson had to become a fish farmer for a while because Jethro Tull was slow. You know, and he did something else he was passionate about. It's no big deal. It all works out.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is my original bass mentor, when I was 22 years old in New York City in 1978, I took Will Lee's place in Joe Beck's band. And Will and Joe were my heroes and my mentors back then. And Will handed me the charts and a Seamoon Funk Machine. And he said, which is an envelope follower, very rare. He handed me that and I looked at it and I went, whoa. And he said, you're going to need that to play Cactus, right? That's the sound of the song Cactus off the record. And he said, lose the charts before the first gig.
Yeah.
And I looked up at him because he's like a little taller than me. And I go, lose the charts? I took him literally. He goes, no, man, just don't bring them to the last rehearsal. Leave them home. He goes, you'll have a better first gig if you don't bring the charts to the last rehearsal. So in that spirit, as a studio musician, if your technique is to chart the music, right, try to get off the chart as quickly as you can, if you can, while you're recording, regardless of what your chart is, whatever you're using to cue yourself to remember what you're supposed to play, right? Like there's that, what I'm saying is maintain that fine line between spontaneity and command of the music. Okay.
Yeah.
And people have varying gifts for their ability to do that. In the last 3 years, one of the things I worked on is not reading the chart after I've got a track, right?
Yeah.
Try to play it when I know I'm in the pocket, in the ball game. I understand the song and I know my parts, right? Get off the written page as quickly as possible. And in fact, sometimes don't do the first take with the chart if you can, but never compromise your musicality or the financial thing of the session or the vibe of the session to test yourself in that realm. You know what I mean.
Just try to get off the chart, articulate. Yeah.
As quickly as you can and play from the heart instead of playing the reading music. And those three pieces of advice is what I would say. Okay. Because one is relational. It's about how you're relating to the people around you and the circumstances, the context you create in the room as a person, as a human being. The second piece of advice was fiscal. Have as many income streams as possible. Like if you know what that means. If you're a guitar player,
sure.
Not only play electric guitar, but get your acoustic guitar chops together. Maybe you have a pro tool, a gift for doing pro tools. Maybe you're also a savvy stock guy. You can make a little money on the stock market, whatever, have multiple income streams. And then the third piece of advice is what Will told me, you know,
get
your heart in the music as soon as you can. Like try to get off the chart as quickly as possible.
Excellent advice.
If you can.
Excellent. Thanks, well, Paul. This has been great.
Thank all my mentors. Nothing original. It all came from other people.
Even so. You can find out more about Paul on his Facebook page. That's facebook.com/PaulIll. I-L-L, Paul Ill. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, do send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.